The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, writer Kate Nelson is going to tell us about Storied Rock. Her article was published in the May 2024 issue of National Geographic. As the editors note on the title page, for millennia, indigenous peoples etched and painted their stories across the landscape of present-day North America. Today, as more artworks are revealed, Native and non-Native experts are bringing a rich cultural heritage into view. Now, included with the article are several photographs of petroglyphs, pictographs, and geoglyphs. Now, before I read the main article, which is not very long, I'm going to read the captions that accompany these pictures, so join me now as we take a look. And the first one is entitled The Three Rivers Petroglyph. This was formed, believed, somewhere between 800 and 1400 years ago in New Mexico. Created by the Jornada Mogollon people, this carving, thought to be of a large cat with a rattlesnake tail, is one of 21,000 densely packed petroglyphs spanning 1 mile of basaltic ridge set against the picturesque Sierra Blanca. Again, that's in New Mexico. And then we have a quote from archaeologist Joe Watkins of the Choctaw Nation. It says, "None of us want to fade away without having made our mark on the landscape." And then there is this interesting picture of some footprints, and I read the caption, "Immortalized in gypsum-rich deposits, these footprints at New Mexico's White Sands National Park are more than 20,000 years old and upend previous assumptions about the duration of human life in North America. It's geographical, geological, and climatological happenstance that they are there," says Watkins. "You can see this path that people took 20,000 years ago as they walked across the landscape, and it looks like footprints in the sand, as you might find at the beach." Next, we have the Sago Canyon pictographs. Now, these were believed done somewhere between 300 and 2,000 years ago. Again, these are wide ranges of time because it's very difficult to really pinpoint it. And we have the caption, "This awe-inspiring place has three major distinct panels, each from a different cultural and temporal time period, including Barrier Canyon, Fremont, and Ute," says former state archaeologist Kevin Jones. "These richly colored paintings, some depicting oversized ghostly figures and other minute animal-like attendants, reflect the Barrier Canyon people's sophisticated use of long-lasting polychromatic pigments. Sadly, the site has been subject to gunshots and graffiti over the years, though conservators have tried to minimize the damage." So you can see the challenge set before them. Then we have the Halo Shelter pictographs, formed about 2,000 years ago. These are found in Texas. One of the best preserved examples of Pecos River-style pictographs on Halo Shelter's limestone wall features a complex 100-foot composition of 103 anthropomorphic or human-like figures intermixed with animalistic figures and enigmatic icons. These represent ancestral deities and spiritual beings associated with the artist's sacred stories, says artist-turned-archaeologist Carolyn Boyd, founder of the Shumla Archaeological Research and Education Center. The organization's extensive radiocarbon dating indicates that this intricate mural was planned out and painted in a single episode, requiring significant time and effort away from hunting and gathering. Then we move to the 19th Unnamed Cave, as it's called. This one, somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 years ago, found in Alabama. Now, by the time they noticed faint tracings on this subterranean mud surface, cave explorer Alan Kressler and archaeologist and University of Tennessee professor emeritus Jan Simek had spent years studying the cave art together in areas unreachable by natural light. But it wasn't until photographer Stephen Alvarez produced a 3D model using photogrammetric technology that they could actually visualize the 6-foot-tall anthropomorph in regalia. It's one of thousands of intricate, extremely fragile drawings known as mud glyphs, adorning the ceiling of a 5,000-square-foot chamber that's just 2 feet high in spots, requiring its indigenous artists to lie down and draw these works by torchlight. Imagine that going on about 2,000 years ago. Wow. Well, next we have the Rochester Panel. This was formed somewhere between 700 and 4,000 years ago in Utah. On a narrow peninsula above the confluence of Rochester Wash and Muddy Creek, this sacred site is home to 13 panels, a barrier canyon, and Fremont-style petroglyphs and pictographs. The main panel shows more than 100 figures, including mythical beasts and more recognizable animals and plants. Spiritual elder Larry Sespuch, a Ute Indian tribe member, and archaeologist Jamie Hollingsworth, Navajo Nation, explained the rainbow could indicate a connection to the spiritual world, a blessing, a protective force, or perhaps a more literal plea for rain in an arid climate. And it's quite unique. It covers 2 pages in this magazine. And it's got some interesting dark purplish-style colors and hues, but you can make out the various drawings, and it looks like a lot of stick figures, if you will, but if you look more closely, it's a little more intricate than that. It's quite interesting. Then we have the Toller petroglyphs. Now, these were believed done between 400 and 500 years ago. They're found in Wyoming. Added to the National Register of Historic Places a decade ago, this sandstone rock formation features more than 30 petroglyphs scattered across 500 feet. As Watkins explains, ancient indigenous artworks often reflect a connection of people to place, including the flora, fauna, and cosmology of an area. That's exemplified in this depiction of a horse and rider created by Plains Tribe artist, which pays homage to indigenous peoples' long-standing relationship with equines. The outcrop also includes carvings of anthropomorphs, warriors, bears, and other cultural motifs. And when they say outcropping, you're really talking about the edge of a cliff, more or less. So this is a wall seen from the outside. It's not a cave, per se. It can lead into a cave or kind of a lean-to type shelter effect from the rock. Then we have the Serpent Mound effigy. Now, this believed to have been done about 900 years ago. This is found in Ohio. In 2021, the Shawnee people returned to their ancestral homelands to reclaim the world's largest remaining earthwork effigy, whose origins have long been the subject of pseudoscientific theories. Our people built this, not giants, not ancient aliens, says Chief Barnes. This magnificent work of civil engineering is a massive community endeavor. I want my people to experience the ceremony of going home and seeing this sacred serpent built with soil that our ancestors held in their hands. And so from the air, you see what looks like a serpentine figure raised out of the flat ground with a beautiful forest. This was taken sometime during the fall because you can see from the color of the foliage. But anyway, it looks like a giant snake winding through these acreages surrounded by forest. Quite spectacular. But amazing indeed. And that was a lot of work, too, when you take a look at how well it's done. Then we have the Blythe Entelios. And this was done about 450 to 2,000 years ago, roughly. And this was found in California. Some of the most notable of the American West hundreds of geoglyphs, these giant distinct figures, 6 in total with the largest measuring 171 feet long, were designed by scraping away the dark desert varnish to reveal lighter-colored stones. Though the artists behind these so-called Nazca lines of North America and their intentions remain unknown, the Mojave and Quechan peoples of the lower Colorado River believe the human figures represent Mastamo, the creator of all life, while the animal figures represent Halakula, who helped the creation. So, and it looks like a huge figure enclosed in kind of a coffin-like structure, or at least design. And then it's got an animal above it. So it's almost like it's a giant urn seen from the air. So you're talking about acres of work here, not just a little 2x4 section in a stone. Quite amazing to see from the air. Next, we have the Three Rivers petroglyphs. This is 800 to 1400 years ago, found in New Mexico. This is set along the eastern slope of the Tularosa Basin, part of the Rio Grande Rift. This site is one of the Southwest's most notable petroglyph areas. The more than 21,000 carvings vary in their symbology and technique, with some appearing as scratches and others, such as the bighorn sheep, pierced by a spear and arrow, made using two rocks as a hammer and chisel. Rock art researcher Margaret Barrier thinks that given the lack of nearby habitation sites, this was likely a seasonal gathering place for trading and ceremonies. And this one rock, it's the size of a medium-sized boulder, has a beautiful animal depicted upon it. And then we find other things like bird-like creatures. We see handprints done on yet another stone. And a lizard-like creature is found on a third stone. So very interesting compositions there. Next, we have the Hot Springs pictographs, and this was done less than 2,000 years ago, this one again in Utah. The mysterious Moki Queen got her informal title thanks to a series of white dots arching above her head that many viewers construe as a crown, says archaeologist Kevin Jones. The animal-like figure by her side is often interpreted as a dog. Because of its proximity to Highway 95 and the popular Glen Canyon National Recreation Area, this elaborate, oversized Barrier Canyon-style painting has captured the attention of many adventurers. Other pictographs and petroglyphs adorn nearby canyon walls, and it's a huge canyon wall. It's red rock, too, a lot of red rock here, which is found in that area. Very interesting features there. And our last one is called the Wedding Rocks Petroglyphs. This was believed done between 200 and 500 years ago. It's found in Washington State. Hikers consider themselves lucky to stumble upon these unmarked petroglyphs located along the Olympic National Park's Pacific coast. Best seen at low tide, the 40-some etchings by Maka artist depict quails, hunters, ships, and other motifs. According to tribal oral history, a mudslide partially destroyed the village of Ozette, one of the Maka tribe's five permanent settlements. Then, in 1970, a severe storm battered the coastline and surfaced about 55,000 preserved artifacts bearing similar iconography. Many of these objects are now on display at the Maka Museum in nearby Nia Bay. So there you go. And these are quite interesting. It's right off the shore of the water, and you see these rocks and a gleam of sunlight coming through. It's mostly a shady area, so they did take some work to find these. But a lot of fish are featured in this, different size fish and designs on these rocks. So quite an interesting undertaking here as we learn more about lifestyles from the past. And as the article goes on to say, there is so much we don't know for certain about ancient indigenous artwork. When precisely was it made? What exactly did it mean to its creators? And yet there is still so much to be learned from these works carved into rock, painted on stone, drawn in mud, or built into the earth's surface. Perhaps most important is that thriving Native American societies, including my own, have inhabited Turtle Island, as many as tribal peoples prefer to call North America, for tens of thousands of years. So, considered alongside a contemporary Native reckoning with historic indigenous representation across everything from politics to pop culture, these sophisticated petroglyphs, pictographs, and geoglyphs help connect our past to present to future. For Native descendant communities, this art represents a return home and a revitalization of the traditional life ways that were all but destroyed by colonialism. We're so lucky that we still have our religion, our culture, our language. Every tribal nation understands the fight to preserve those, says Chief Ben Barnes of the Shawnee tribe, whose ancestors likely built the Serpent Mound effigy in Ohio. Many Americans have forgotten that land itself can be sacred, that spaces can be holy. Here in the Americas, our holy spaces are indigenous, he said. Photographer Stephen Alvarez has been documenting natural wonders for nearly three decades. He founded the nonprofit Ancient Arts Archive in 2016 as a living record of prehistoric paintings and engravings worldwide. Now he has focused his lens on America's murals, an effort to put this nation's 250th anniversary in 2026 in the context of millennia-old history. The landscape tells its own story, says Alvarez, what happened to it over time, who lived there, and what they did. You cannot separate the artwork and the landscape. For the archaeologists, anthropologists, ethnographers, and artists and other knowledge keepers, both native and non-native, who have spent much time studying and preserving these artworks, they are masterpieces as well as miracles withstanding the elements for centuries, so people may wonder at and about them today. None of us want to fade away without having made our mark on the landscape, says archaeologist Joe Watkins of Choctaw Nation, who works on Alvarez's Mural of America project. Rock art gives us an opportunity to share insights from people who no longer walk this earth, he said. For everyone, this artwork is a call to recognize and revere the legacies that ancient indigenous peoples left behind. It's an urging to acknowledge the traumas that our communities have endured on Turtle Island and beyond. And it's a reminder that Native Americans have long been here and that our voices, stories, and art from the past matter just as much as what we're creating today and what we'll create tomorrow. So, fascinating story there about indigenous storied rock. Next, we're going to go to England, where writer Adam Nicholson is going to tell us about water from chalk. Now, as the editors note, welling up through white porous rock, England's chalk streams are prized by anglers and poets alike. Now, supporters are wading in to help them thrive. The article appeared in the May 2024 issue of National Geographic. Step into the water of an English chalk stream, 2 or 3 feet deep, shaded by willows and alders, and you'll feel the pressure and cold of it all around your knees and thighs. The gravel underfoot is dappled with sunlight reaching down to the river floor. All around you, the motion of the water is sustained and untroubled, the current never urgent because chalk streams are spring-fed and little silt finds its way into them. Visibility is aquarium clear. The trout within them seem to hang in the air. These streams take their quality from the rock over which they run, alkaline, mineral-rich, with dissolved calcium carbonate but almost no sediment, flowing to the sea over many miles of clean flint gravel bed, bubbling up from springs that emerge from deep aquifers in the chalk. They run through valleys fringed with water mint and clusters of water forget-me-nots, often thick with life-sheltering weeds. Not subject to surges of rivers that run over harder rocks, they flow steadily through the English chalk country, whose gentle landforms billow across the nation's southern and eastern reaches. Chalk is a pure type of limestone, composed of mostly tiny shells of marine organisms. Deposits are found worldwide, but in England, the geological ripples from the rising of the Alps some 40 million years ago brought a wide swath of it to the surface. It's porous and fractured, with up to 40% of its bulk made up of spaces between the rock grains. Rain that falls on chalk sinks into the ground, sometimes taking months to percolate through the hills. In that way, the rivers have a kind of steady maturity about them. Rainstorms produce no floods, and in drought, the rivers continue to run. The water acquires the temperature of the rock, 50 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit, all year. This means that the plants and animals that live in the chalk streams can depend on continuity. If you go snorkeling in a chalk stream, you'll find yourself in another world, so absorbing that nothing else encroaches, says Nicola Crockford, inveterate river snorkeler and conservationist with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. There are flowering water crowfoots, whose white blossoms unfold first underwater, as well as patches of bright green starworts with trout and grayling loitering in their shadows. On the gravel bed, larval cases of caddis flies look like tiny sticks. Young trout, parr, tiger-striped, and quivering hold their own in some corner of the current, their bodies never still. Farther off in the green dark of the stream, larger fish melt away carefully. Anyone connected with these rivers talks about them with undisguised love. Zam Baring, who with his brother and sisters run the Grange at Etchinstoke in Hampshire, one of England's leading sparkling wine vineyards, says the vines have their heads in the chalky Hampshire Downs and their toes in the sparkling headwaters of the River Etchin. To go wading deep into the tributary that runs below the vineyard, he said, is to think you've gone to floaty heaven. A lifelong fisherman and co-vice chair of the Wessex Rivers Trust, Baring has helped lead numberless river restorations and celebrates even the smallest streams. You'll find all kinds of beauties in a quarter of an inch of water, he says. Russell Biggs, who champions the needs of chalk streams in the rest of the country, says the tiny river Bavinley saved his life. His waste recycling business was struggling and driving him to despair. I would get home when he pauses and then just come here, walk by the river. I think of it in a flat in a city center. I would just not be around, but that way it gives you a reason, he says. Well, these are not the waterways of a remote wilderness. The fisherman, journalist, and author Charles Wrangley Wilson calls chalk streams the rivers of habitable country. It is beauty on your doorstep, he says. But because they are on your doorstep, they are also very threatened. Human damage often began thousands of years ago and led to a crescendo of change and destruction in the mid-20th century. Cities and farms casually polluted them. Property owners dammed or widened them, slowing their current, ironing out their natural meanders, and removing fallen trees, which make life difficult for anglers, but good for fish and other river life. Slowing a river causes thick mats of silt to settle on the stream bed, and blanket the gravel, whose clean, aerated spaces the trout and salmon need to lay their eggs. Beneficial weeds, nurseries for invertebrates, grow only in bright, fast water. Without the weeds, the all-important insect life, the many different species of mayflies, stoneflies, and caddisflies collapses. Without the bug life, there is no fish life, no wild brown trout or grayling. Without the fish life, there is no otter life, and none of the magical, quick, quivering presence that gives the rivers their own life. Miles of the Etchen and the famous River Test, which runs down through the Hampshire Chalk to its mouth near Southampton, have been turned into easy fishing parks with carefully mown banks, gingerbread fishing huts, and huge nursery-raised trout. Fees to fish the most celebrated stretches can run to more than $600 a day. The fast bubbling water and the varied ecological niches of the natural stream have been erased. There is also, invariably, in a crowded country, the pervasive influence of pollution. Detergents, microplastic, pharmaceuticals, and heavy metals, as well as waste that's flushed down toilets, all arrive in the streams. Fisherman Paul Jennings has seen his local sewage works discharge waste into the River Chess, north of London, for more than 90 days, 68 days without a break. It was dreadful. You didn't want to go into it. A smell, a muddy color, nasty, gray, and horrible with bits in it, he says. After rain, the first thing you see coming down the river is the diesel washed off the road, says riverkeeper Peter Farrow, who works for a private estate that includes a stretch of the test. Soil from careless plowing near the rivers chokes many of the clean gravels on which the fish rely. Overuse of phosphate and nitrate fertilizers in agriculture overstimulates the rivers, whose beds then clog with filamentous weeds, which smother invertebrate eggs, get in the gills of fish, and choke out the beneficial plants, the oxygenators, says freshwater ecologist Janina Gray, deputy CEO of the conservation group Wildfish. A political system that puts cheap tap water before river health has not helped. If anything is worse than a polluted chalk stream, it's a river that has been denied the water of its very life, water that has been sucked from the underlying aquifers to service human needs. In some places, the water table has dropped more than 20 feet. If you have a river that's dry, there is no point in worrying about water quality and habitat because it's just not a river, says Wrangley Wilson. Flow is fundamental. All across chalk country, river advocacy groups have emerged in the past few years. Forced to stay home during pandemic lockdowns, many people discovered the local rivers and public pressure for change has never been more intense. Over the past 20 years or so, advocacy groups, water companies, and government departments have written a series of large-scale, multi-decade plans for reservoirs, desalination plants, domestic water meters, and water transfer networks to reduce the amount of water taken from the chalk. Increasingly, rivers are having their natural form restored. Simon King began almost single-handedly to invent chalk stream restoration in England after being jolted into action one grievous summer afternoon in 1984. As he fished the River Ebble in Wiltshire, the water turned chocolate, he says. Upstream, he could see a large orange machine moving its digger arm in and out of the riverbed. The Ebble was being dredged with government funding to lower the water table in the surrounding meadows, perhaps to make them suitable for arable crops. In the detritus, Kane spotted hundreds of rare and endangered crayfish, all gasping for breath and obviously trying to survive. 40 years later, the same stretch of the Ebble remains a sad and weathered thing. The three cardinal virtues of a healthy river are gradient, velocity, and sinuosity, says Kane, who founded a company specializing in river restoration. Over the past decades, his firm has reshaped numerous rivers into healthier form, removing weirs and dams, roughening their flow, adding the twists and turns that create varied habitats for plants, invertebrates, and fish. Many river restorers have followed in Kane's path, among them Rangeley Wilson, who has worked with Kane to reinvigorate a stretch of the River Nar in North Norfolk. For centuries, it has been trapped in a straight channel leading to a mill. With no gradient, no sinuosity, and no flow, the river has died a sluggish, silty death. But over the past few years, Rangeley Wilson has been reconnecting the Nar to its valley, restoring its meanders, dragging in some trees to disrupt the flow and diversify the habitat, and allowing natural processes free rein. The cost of restoration can run about $130,000 per mile of river, usually funded by government grants and support from landowners. I went fishing with Rangeley Wilson one afternoon, and as we came to a new bit of channel less than 2 years old, the river ran and chuckled loosely beside us. Within 30 seconds, Rangeley Wilson had hooked a wild trout, then another, and another. All were small, only a half pound or so, but then he spotted something more. Oh, there's a nice trout. It's going to hide under the bank there. He landed his fly, the rod bent, and he brought the trout into the gravel shallows. The river he had made was full of life. Slipping the barbless fly from the trout's jaw, he held it to the surface of the stream, allowing the water to lap over the red and black sprinkles of its body. Then he let it ghost away, an emblem of the beauty of the streams that we all hope one day be restored to life. Wow, quite a story there, huh? And a very interesting one. By the way, there is a thing called stream samplers along some of these stretches of streams. Privately owned, glimpses of their beauty can be enjoyed on footpaths and bridge crossings, and there's also fishing charters available if you like. One in Hampshire County, the Testway, begins at Inkpen and ends 44 miles later at Ealing. You also can get day tickets to fish stretches of more than a dozen chalk streams. And you can get more online at fishingbreaks.co.uk. That's fishingbreaks.co.uk. And these prices, by the way, to fish go from $100 to $600 a day. So kind of an interesting experience there, to say the least. And that, my friends, is going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. I remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.